Hi everyone, this is Meg. Toby and I are having so much fun making Radio Free Dystopia, in no small part because it's meant getting to interact with awesome listeners like you. We are super flattered to have 10 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts right now, and it would mean so much if we could get to 25 reviews by early July. So if you like the show and have a couple minutes to leave a review or even just a rating on Apple Podcasts, that would really help us out. Also, wanted to give you a heads up that we are planning a show about young adult dystopian fiction, and we'd love your recommendations for great dystopian books for kids and young adults. Please let us know by email, or even better, voicemail at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast about what we learn when dystopian fiction and current events start to look the same. I'm here with my co-host, Toby Ball, a writer of dystopian novels and panelist on the hit podcast Crime Writers On. Our guest today is Paul Fisher, an award-winning film producer and author of a fantastic nonfiction book called A Kim Jong-il Production, the extraordinary true story of a kidnapped filmmaker, his star actress, and a young dictator's rise to power. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're really glad you're here, Paul, because the book is just fabulous. It's absolutely spectacular. Toby told me about it a couple weeks ago, and I picked it up the other day, and I've been binge reading it ever since. And I'm really hoping that before we get too deep into the discussion, you could maybe give us a quick summary of the story for listeners who might not be familiar with it.
Sure, of course. So the book's nonfiction. It's about a true story. In the 1970s, Kim Jong-il, who would go on to become the leader of North Korea and would be caricatured, and everybody would know Kim Jong-il at the time, his father ran the country and he was the minister of propaganda in North Korea, and he was film obsessed. And North Korean films weren't good enough, so he decided in the late 70s that he would kidnap or have kidnapped the leading South Korean filmmaker and his ex-wife, who was a very famous actress, have them brought to North Korea and essentially force them to make propaganda films for him. And that's kind of the plot, and then the whole backdrop of the book is kind of about how Kim Jong-il created the theater state of North Korea as we know it now. Through movies and operas and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, that term theater state is so appropriate and really echoes a lot of what I was thinking as I was reading the book. North Korea has been in the news a lot lately, and it feels like every time you watch something on the news about events going on in North Korea, it feels like you're trying to dissect pageantry in addition to interpreting geopolitics. And reading the book really gave me a more solid grounding into why that is. Toby, what do you think?
It seems as though totalitarian states have such... it's so important for them to have a certain image, sort of both inwardly and outwardly projected. So it's sort of in line with other things like the Potemkin villages in Russia, where they set up these fake villages. So when dignitaries were, I can't even remember what river it was, going up and down the river on a boat, it looked like there were these happy villages there, but they were just, you know, they were fronts. And we'll probably end up talking like later about like Leni Riefenstahl and stuff. But again, it was this idea that you're creating an image of the country and of the state, which is very sort of artificial and manufactured for visuals rather than sort of an accurate representation of what's actually going on.
So Paul, I want to ask you a bit about your reporting process, because the book reads like fiction, and I mean that as a huge compliment. It is so packed with details and characters and depth and sense of place and time that I had to keep reminding myself that this wasn't fiction. You had to go and dig up all of these many details, and a lot of that reporting happened in a society that tends to be fairly opaque. And I was hoping that you could talk to us a little bit about what your reporting process was like and how you separated the theater state from the truth.
Well, there are kind of a couple of different ways. The kind of guiding principle was, if I can't corroborate something at least a couple of times from a few different sources that are unrelated to one another, then maybe I should treat it like it's not true. And that was kind of step one. And then step two was, if I did get enough sources, you know, who are these sources? Because one of the issues with North Korea is the accounts you will get will be from defectors. And, you know, defectors, whether they're, you know, from the sort of upper echelon of class in North Korea, whether they're poor people who've escaped, there's sort of an awareness of a narrative to be presented, and there's grudges that they carry, and they have their own narrative that can feed into, you know, the kind of psychological experience of being made to kind of worship the Kims, and then that all falling apart and how they talk about it. So it's about getting several sources, being really careful about who the sources were, and that there wasn't a kind of self-interest to lying or to making stuff up. And then beyond that, just triple checking everything. And, you know, with one of the main sources for the book was obviously Shin Sang-ok and Choi Eun-hee's own account of what happened. Okay. You know, so I started there and checked and triple checked and double checked everything with dates and maps and, you know, Google Earth satellite images. You know, you essentially kind of have to take everything like it's a lie that you're trying to disprove. And if you can't disprove it, and if somebody else has kind of said something about it that matches, then you might be onto something. And I kind of tried to do that because I wanted it to read in a kind of novelistic, immediate, journalistic kind of way.
You know, one of the other things that really impressed me about the book is how much ground it covers in terms of time and technology. It's quite a study in how the rapid development of communications technology is giving us more tools to tell stories, both for creative reasons and reasons of, you know, in the case of North Korea and other places, propaganda. And that has me thinking a lot about some other emerging technologies that have been in the news lately that could someday be used for these types of purposes.
Time for another fact-filled edition of The News from Dystopia.
You've probably heard now that Elon Musk wants to recreate the Matrix. Or at least that's what some headline writers have been saying. Musk is a super smart entrepreneur who's perhaps best known for PayPal, SpaceX, and Tesla. And he's launched a new startup recently. It's called Neuralink, and it's hired all sorts of researchers to develop something called neural lace, which is basically a wireless connection between computers and human brains. The technology could be a boon to people with serious diseases and, according to Musk, a way to prevent artificial intelligence from taking over the world. Headline writers have, as you'd imagine, had a lot of fun with this. Yahoo News wrote, "Elon Musk wants to computerize your brain." Mashable said, "What we know about Elon Musk's plan to go full supervillain and play with your brain." And Vanity Fair is my favorite. "Elon Musk's billion-dollar crusade to stop the AI apocalypse." Now, coverage and conversation of Musk's plans have had lots of references to fictional franchises. In addition to The Matrix, people have talked about Black Mirror, a number of other dystopian novels that are out there, too. So definitely an example of the types of factual and fictional parallels that we talk about on this show. It also gives us a window into how emerging technologies like augmented and virtual reality, wearables, and implants can create new opportunities for storytelling, including propaganda.
This has been the news from Dystopia. Until next time, stay hopeful.
So what do you guys think, Paul and Toby, about the potential for emerging technologies to change the way that propaganda is disseminated?
It's very Philip Dick.
How so?
I think. Well, I mean, he writes a lot about different things, but in ways in which people are minds are either controlled or manipulated in ways they don't know. Why am I spacing this? The that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where he
Total Recall.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that it's that kind of thing. I think it was like we will dream it for you at half price or whatever was the name of the short story. But this idea that you get memories of this wonderful vacation implanted in you rather than actually having to take the vacation. Philip K. Dick's world is not. For the most part, it's fairly dystopian. I mean, it's not just one world, but these sort of scenarios he spins out are, for the most part, sort of warnings and dystopias. It's a little bit different, it seems, than just sort of sitting back and sort of passively letting your brain take in, you know, stimulus or information, but to have it actually sort of implanted there seems like a completely kind of different thing.
You know, when I work on films, I get fascinated by VR, and I've been to a few of these, I don't know if they're conferences or whatever, but you can try whatever VR, AR experiences people are trying out. And I think the thing that's weird is, or not weird, but new, is it kind of takes down all the layers of engagement you have with something. And I think for VR, for instance, you know, one of the great things is that kind of transference of experience that creates empathy that, you know, a movie or documentary tries to do happens a lot more immediately and involvingly and engagingly, which at the same time means if you were able to lie convincingly in VR, that kind of sneaks past all your layers of detachment, of you know, suspension of belief, of kind of reasoning about it, and just hits you immediately. And so the question, I guess, with a dictator, a dystopian kind of regime, is how you apply that sort of technology to, you know, a large group of people, and how you also use it to block out the information or technology you don't want to get through. And also, I guess, you know, if you can connect people's minds or brains to a device, then how much access does that give you to whatever's going on in the mind or brain? And that kind of second direction that information can go, how much can you spy on people, monitor people, control people? You know, those are all things that I think if you had a fairly, you know, a forward-thinking dictator would be on their mind, just as a different level of kind of information and consciousness control.
Yeah, and you know, we're already seeing a manifestation of that on social media. Extremist groups of all sorts of stripes have been using Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and other social spaces to rally and organize and recruit and get their messages out for years now. And I know in journalism, it's a constant struggle to present that information in a way that is honest about what's out there and how these platforms are being used, but also provides appropriate context and tries to separate truth from propaganda. And I can only imagine that as the development of augmented and virtual reality continues, that balance point's going to get even harder to find. And the power of those tools to really sway our perception of reality is just going to get so much more complicated.
Yeah, and one of the emotions, I think, on a social media thing, I feel, and this is quite similar to what Kim Jong-il did in North Korea, is it kind of appeals to nostalgia or a sense of reality as you would like it to be. You know, a lot of the North Korean state as Kim Jong-il invented worked for people because he said, you know, this is what our country is, this is our national identity, and that kind of fit the image that North Koreans or many North Koreans wanted to have of themselves, having been a country between Japan and China and Russia that for hundreds of years was sort of used as a battleground. Suddenly this propaganda narrative gave them kind of a sense of destiny and a sense of identity separate from that, and a sense of, you know, being exceptional, an exceptional resistance on the world stage. You know, and the stuff that happens on social media, any kind of radicalization seems to exploit that same kind of thing, that same kind of desire to be at the center of a narrative that, you know, brings back either the world as it used to be, as you imagined it to be, as you wish it would be. You know, and there's something about, you know, VR being connected to something, or, you know, you're obviously connected to these inputs and stuff and devices, but it's also sort of narcissistic experience. You're at the heart of the experience. It's about you experiencing this thing. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be one of the ways that creating these propaganda narratives really works.
Well, it seems like the dictator playbook in some ways, you know, in that you're, you know, you think about Putin now, and just sort of appealing to Russians' sense of themselves. And I wish I knew a little bit more about the details of it, but it seems that he kind of combines both nostalgia from the time when they were a superpower, and able to, you know, look the U.S. and the West in the eye, as well as sort of, you know, older history, I guess, and sort of bringing in the Orthodox Church into part of the national identity. So, you know, and obviously, you know, Hitler and his idea of Germanness, you know, Yugoslavia having some sort of myths to hold them together. But then especially after it fragmented, you know, the Serbian myth of, you know, basically losing quite a bit. You know, one of the things with wanting to hold on to Kosovo was the importance in the Serbian myth of the Battle of Kosovo, which was in like 1389, I think. So, you know, 600 years ago, where they were crushed by the Turks. But that was such a strong piece of myth for them that even though, you know, ethnically that region was more Albanian than Serb, they wanted to hold on to it because of the sort of national identity that it conferred.
Yeah, I think that's a strong man kind of through line to go back to the idea of the Potemkin villages and all that. It's kind of the idea of, you know, create or emphasize a grievance that kind of creates a sense of community because you can invent this sense of self that's kind of idealized. And then obviously because there's no follow through and it's about people at the top enriching themselves, that's where the propaganda kind of comes in terms of creating this alternate reality where things are great and everything's fine, to kind of validate that, yes, I had a strong man came in and worked on his grievance, and now we are in the sort of utopia or closer to utopia. Or, you know, it's one of those things where either you, and North Korea has done this where, you know, they've got their version of the theater state where everything is performed to make it seem like everything's fine, and then they've got kind of keeping that grievance alive constantly because you have to be frozen in that moment of grievance. You know, in that moment of we hate Americans and we hate the Japanese and we hate whatever, because otherwise, you know, without the other, there's no sense of self. And so there's a direct through line between, you know, taking that loss, turning it into something that can create the kind of invented, emphasized, idealized national identity, and then having to, you know, fake reality and create propaganda to give the impression of progress or of success.
Right. I thought that was one of the many really interesting things about the book, was that when the Koreas split, or were, I guess they didn't split, but two were created, sort of the inward facing propaganda in which they were trying to sort of co-opt like all the Korean myths as being specifically kind of taking place in North Korea, with like the unicorn den. Is that right?
Yeah.
That was one of the things that struck me. It's like, you know, you're taking all this stuff pretty literally at that point when you've identified the den where the unicorn lived. But then the early films that, that Kim Jong-il was involved in sort of creating this, it seemed like sort of a combination of Korean cultural mythology or heritage and sort of blending it with his father, you know, as being sort of the, I don't know if it's culmination of it is or apex or whatever, but putting him in that line and setting him up as sort of the, you know, the uber Korean, I guess.
Yeah, very much kind of misidentifying and very much, you know, yeah, the Korean. There is a theme to Kim Jong-il era propaganda that, you know, Kim Il-sung, his father, was the purest Korean. And that meant any sense of treason or disagreement and so on wasn't just treason or disagreement. It made you a less pure Korean. And again, you know, it's kind of, that's the you know, the use of language that dictators take advantage of. You know, the Nazis had their entartete Kunst, which, you know, the degenerate art, which meant if you made something they didn't agree with, it didn't just mean you were, you know, different or un-German. It meant you were degenerate and immoral. You know, we have it in the West now where, you know, people aren't real Americans or real Englishmen or real whatever if they disagree in any sense. And the North Koreans just made that quite explicit, where, like, exactly as you said, history led to this moment, which is Kim Il-sung, which is, you know, why the propaganda gets a bit inconsistent after that, because they've had to sort of reinvent, you know, oh, when we meant Kim Il-sung, we meant Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, because we're all the same guy. And so, you know, and so that's why now they kind of write myth on the fly, as it were. That's sort of the weird genius of it. Is you know, Kim Jong-il was able to at the same time say, we hate the Japanese, they've colonized us, they're horrible, et cetera, et cetera. And then co-opt all the symbolism of the Japanese empire for his own propaganda. And people would swallow that. And there was a kind of genius to Kim Jong-il in that sense, where he could denounce one thing, but also see the things about its propaganda that made it work, and then just steal it and use it for himself and still claim that that was particularly Korean since, you know, the earliest days of time. And because it pressed all the right emotional buttons, you know, kind of make that all make sense, even if it doesn't.
So a quick aside for those of you who are perhaps listening to this conversation and maybe don't have a lot of base knowledge about the history of the Korean Peninsula, please don't worry about it. That should not dissuade you from reading the book. Paul does an absolutely fantastic job of providing historical context and really the origin story of North and South Korea in a way that is incredibly accessible, incredibly readable, and incredibly useful, especially given how much that region has been in the news lately. So don't let a lack of working knowledge about the history of the Korean Peninsula dissuade you from reading this.
Thank you. My sneaky advantage writing the book is when I started, I knew very little. And so, like most people, you know, North Korea is in the news all the time, but I didn't really know it beyond what I read in the paper. So I had to do a bit of research to make sense of all of it. You know, as Toby will know, kind of the process of editing a book, you know, my editor was very adamant to keep all that stuff as minimal as possible so we could get to the sexy stuff, which is kidnappings and prisons and all those kind of things.
Yeah, that there's a tendency to, like, you do all this research, you find out this kind of cool stuff, and then I think it's hard for people sometimes to be willing to shove some of that stuff away because it doesn't necessarily help with the story. That's not the issue with this book. I mean, it's just very lean, I think.
Yeah. Well, the first couple drafts weren't.
Yeah. Well, I know how that goes,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
So speaking of the origins of this book, we got a voice memo from a listener, and she has a great question for you, Paul, about where this book got started. So I'm going to play that right now, and then maybe we can talk about it a little bit.
Hi, Toby and Meg. Hi, Paul. This is Anna Schaefer in New York City, and I would dearly love to know how Paul originally got turned on to this fantastic story and ended up getting just kind of sucked down the DPRK wormhole of total insanity. Thanks a lot.
Well, hi, Anna. I live in England, so it involved a newspaper and a pub.
That's great.
Of course.
I work as a filmmaker, and I've been vaguely aware of the Kim Jong-il cinema stuff because, you know, film festivals, people talk about weird film stories. But there was an article in The Guardian a long, long time ago about Kim Jong-il. And I think it was an article about maybe when Hennessy revealed that he was their biggest customer or something like that. And the kind of the closer of the article was a little paragraph coda, you know, that kind of went, Kim Jong-il is notorious for, you know, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but notorious for weird stuff. You know, he's got a sushi chef, he does this. And when he was younger, he allegedly kidnapped his favorite filmmaker. That was the phrasing. And so that was the first time I'd heard of it. And at the time I thought, okay, well, I haven't heard anything about this story. So it's either fake or it must have been tiny, kind of, you know, fait divers. It must have been a thing where he kidnapped this guy, had him for a few hours, they made him give him back, but that could be a cool, like, low budget movie or a play, just two guys in a room in a few hours. And then I was in the pub with my girlfriend, having a couple of pints, and I brought it up for some reason, and she asked me exactly what happened. And I had to admit that I wasn't sure. I hadn't really looked it up. So we took our phones out and started Googling. And that was me done. I was kind of obsessed with that for 2 years. I think I went back home and wrote like the first draft of the proposal that evening. This wasn't just a nobody filmmaker who's extremely famous. This was a thing that lasted 8 years. This is a thing that most people say never happened and was invented by the people who were kidnapped. Was all fascinating. And then I think, you know, the clincher was I found somewhere online one of the first pictures I saw of Kim Jong-il as a young man. Kind of looking super hipster cool, with the sunglasses and the camel hair coat, and I was just like, okay, that's not the guy I picture. This sounds good. And you know, it's one of those things. And this happens in North Korea, where, you know, under every cool stone you turn over, there's a bigger, cooler stone.
And so you went in your reporting. You actually went to North Korea, correct?
I did. Yeah, I went for about a week. And it was, you know, it was a minor dilemma, but it was one of those things where, you know, I can't really write about a place without going to that place. So, you know, it was kind of with the awareness that, you know, okay, I'll be shown things that are extremely controlled, but there's something in that control and what you choose to show and not show that, you know, will be informative to some degree.
How did you get into North Korea?
Most people will go through tour operators who are based in China.
Okay.
And essentially go as tourists, which is a scam, and something that sort of uses leverage. For me, I used someone who had worked at one of those tour operators to essentially put through the visa paperwork. And the idea was, because my passport had visas for my work as a filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
We figured, okay, let's pitch that I'm a filmmaker, considering doing something in North Korea, co-production something. This, you know, in the last few years, they've been quite keen on that kind of thing. They've made films like Comrade Kim Goes Flying that are made as co-productions with an English company and is, you know, essentially soft propaganda. So that was the pitch. So could I come for about a week, 10 days, show me around, you know, film studios, film stuff. And so they said yes, gave me a visa, made me a schedule kind of centered around film-related things. And, you know, but obviously when you get to North Korea, you get given two guides who stay with you the whole time that you're anywhere other than your hotel room. which is called the four-eye policy, so they can watch you and watch each other at all times. I got a bit lucky in that sense. This is another thing about how a very efficient propaganda state like North Korea has bizarre blind spots, but they assign you guides based on your passport. And my passport is Swiss, so they gave me two guides who speak German, which I do not speak.
So they
had to switch one out at the last minute. So I had one guide who spoke no English and one guide who spoke English. So I was able to speak to her about things the other guy couldn't understand. And so I, you know, spent a week, did that stuff. They were with me the whole time. They were very adamant I shouldn't film stuff because I took my iPhone in. No one stopped me. But because they knew I was a filmmaker, they had no problem with me writing stuff down. So I spent a week just scribbling notes down. Oddly, one of the things that was most useful about going, and I guess you could do that online now because there's enough secondhand resellers, but one of the things they do virtually every day, especially in Pyongyang, is they'll take you to what they call a foreigner's bookshop, which is where they have, you know, propaganda calendars, books, whatever, in foreign languages, in the hope you'll buy souvenirs and that's more money for them and it's overpriced and so on. But the different bookstores would have, for instance, different biographies of Kim Jong-il written at different times. So you could buy a biography, an official biography that was written in the 80s, and then buy one that was bought in 95 when he took power, and compare and contrast to see how they rewrote the Messiah narrative to fit whatever had happened in between.
Wow.
So I was able to stack a bunch of books like that about Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and so on, and then, you know, kind of chart the evolution of how the propaganda was kind of sharpened as they went. And that was really useful.
That's all that stuff is just kind of side by side.
Yeah. Like, so I guess
there's no sense that that's revealing.
I don't think so. Either they, you know, definitely for, so North Korean propaganda has really strong, clever awareness of the fact that they have two audiences. There's the foreign audience and the domestic audience. And you can't give them the same propaganda. And obviously, I think domestically in schools, whatever, the old history goes away and it never gets spoken of again. And people can remember an old history, but you can't talk about it again. So after time, it gets forgotten. But I think in the foreigner's bookshop, it's just an issue of stock, maybe. Stuff's just there and it's full shelves. And, you know, it's not really curated in any way to fit the evolving reality that they're creating. You know, there was one of the films, Shin Sang-ok, made in North Korea while he was kidnapped, was this kind of ninja film called Hong Kil-dong. And all his films are meant to have been banned and removed and you can't speak of him again and all that kind of stuff. But that film is on DVD, kind of in the stores, you know, and it doesn't have the name of a director on it. But, you know, my guide who spoke English was old enough to remember him, so I'm able to pick that up and go, oh, I've heard about this. Who's the guy who directed it? And kind of watch her squirm because she can't say it. So that's one of the things that's really interesting about the propaganda dystopia in North Korea theater state is kind of like, it's not all that black and white. You know, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, you know, do the people really believe all this stuff? And yet the kind of answer is yes and no, and it changes every second. Because everything's inconsistent. And it's got to that point where, you know, you can have stuff that's a direct lie, that's clearly a lie, but now you're sort of daring people to call it a lie, an inconsistency. You know, you can say America's oppressing us while also bringing in bags of rice from international aid that say USA on them. And if somebody calls you out, you'll say, well, those are reparations. But if no one calls you out, you just let them live with the dissonance.
That's like completely the Orwellian, you know, doublethink.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
You kind of understand that you're making the compromise at some level, but at the same time, you sort of get yourself to believe it, and can shift your beliefs depending on context.
Yeah, and it compromises you, you know, and that's, you know, not to use a word that's kind of overused at the moment, but that kind of abusive gaslighting effect, that idea of you're taking advantage of someone by lying to them, you're making them feel responsible or making them buy into it, because there's that doubt or there's a way out, it is you create something that means, you know, essentially we're in this together as opposed to I'm doing this to you.
That kind of gets to the heart of what propaganda is, though, right? I mean, it's this idea that we are all in it together, all rallying around one thing or one cause. You know, my grandmother, who died a few years ago, just shy of 100, you know, she sold war bonds during World War II. And at the end of her life, she didn't remember my name, but she could remember the slogans that she used to sell those bonds and get people to support the war effort. And, you know, I think that we often associate propaganda with these violent, problematic regimes like the one in North Korea, or with, you know, dystopian myth. And really, propaganda is a tool for communication that we see in all aspects of our life. I mean, I've worked for companies before that have used propaganda-like tactics to get employees to turn off the lights so they can save some money. So if we think of North Korea and similar regimes as like propaganda with a capital P, then there's all of this other like lowercase p propaganda. Can you guys think of some examples of that that's been going on?
Well, I think we're going through the whole thing with the Confederate statues, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like there's a very, I mean, it's sort of regional, but, mm-hmm. And I know I'm just going to catch a lot of Twitter flack for this, but, you know, it's the, you know, the mythologizing of the old South, mm-hmm. and, you know, honorable men fighting to preserve a way of life, which was, you know, made possible by slaves.
Right.
But you want to de-emphasize the slave part, and that, you know, now that sort of piece of propaganda is being, you know, in some places taken down, and certainly people feel under threat that it's going to happen in other places. You know, the reaction is harsh, and it's, you know, what I think is kind of interesting about it is that it's not you're taking down this monument or whatever, but it's like you're trying to destroy history, which, you know, I think is pretty clearly not the case. Is you're trying to destroy celebrating somebody whose values sort of no longer seem quite as, I don't know, acceptable.
When you ask the question, there are two things that came to mind for me. One of them is kind of related to the book, and in a sense, one of the reasons Kim Jong-il wanted to make better movies for export is the Japanese had a kind of benign propaganda about, you know, restoring their image after World War II from this kind of colonial bloodthirsty empire to a kind of culturally enlightened country. You know, that was a very conscious effort of propaganda, of, you know, promoting certain films, promoting certain artists, going to foreign film festivals. And that was propaganda. And it wasn't about lying to anybody. It was about putting forwards a certain branding, as it were.
Right.
And so that made me think of that. And then the second thing, which is a lot more benign, you know, I'm a big football fan, a soccer fan. You know, and there's that thing where, you know, if I go to my home stadium in London, mm-hmm. you know, there's massive posters and faces and slogans on the stadium, and there's chants that we've all learned and uniforms we all wear with badges on our chests. And this history and this idea of this is the way we play, and we say we, even though none of the 60,000 people in the stands can kick a ball further than a yard. And, you know, the other guys always have dirty players, but if that same dirty player plays for you, suddenly he's not a dirty player.
Like, he's
player
your anymore. Guy, he's just
savvy. Exactly. And that's kind of the same creation of, you know, creating an illusory we, which in a sense is just entertainment and, I guess, making money. But it's the same kind of use of symbolism and you know, and that's kind of the fine line between all these different things is, you know, for instance, one of the ways the North Korean regime, quote unquote, brainwashed its people. There's sort of a list of steps to use in terms of, you know, isolate people from other forms of input, which is what they did nationally. You know, convince them of a grievance, as Toby was saying, kind of loss, and then give them a solution that they need to rely on you to have, and so on, that they learn from the Chinese. And that's kind of the basis of their propaganda. But it's also literally the exact same steps that happen to anybody who steps in for an assessment in a Scientology Dianetics Center. Mm-hmm. And it's in different language, the way you target a community when you make ads for a tiny independent film that you're just trying to target specific people and make them feel it's about you in a completely benign, different way. But that's why loading the word propaganda with, as you were saying, this idea, it has to be bad. That means bad. Kind of misses the things that make it work and the things that make it kind of all pervasive.
Yeah. And this all really makes me think of the role that propaganda or propaganda-like tactics really plays in politics. And, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the whole point of campaigns is to find candidates who share your views or candidates who are willing to listen to your views. And one way to communicate that is through propaganda-like messaging. It also makes me think of this interesting phenomenon that really gets to the heart of Radio Free Dystopia, and that's been the use lately of archetypes and images from dystopian fiction in real life arenas. And I think a very recent and very common example of that is the protesters who dressed up like handmaids from The Handmaid's Tale, the red robes, the white caps, and showed up at state houses all over the country, including right here in New Hampshire, to protest what they viewed as threats to women's reproductive freedoms. And it was very much this kind of made for social media image that was all over the place. Have you seen anything similar in your travels?
The first one I saw that was similar to that, I can't remember when it was, but they had protests in Hong Kong where they used that Hunger Games finger signal thing as a salute.
Oh.
And I think there were pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, and there's a I think it's a three-fingered salute or something in The Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. And that was used after the films as a sort of salute sign for the movement kind of thing.
We talked in a previous episode about the people wearing the V for Vendetta mask. Mm-hmm. As sort of, I guess, signifying a certain type of anarchy. And the other one is... it was a Republican convention. I can't remember when, but it was right after the Iraqis had held elections where they had to have their finger like stamped in purple. So all these people showing up to the Republican convention were had their fingers painted purple as like showing the wild success that was our Iraq adventure.
And this is weird, but I just wanted to say on the that kind of Handmaid's Tale-y fingerprint ink thing. The one that I thought immediately about, other than the Hunger Games-y thing, and which is kind of, and I wonder if it's interesting that none of us thought about it because it is the most common one. And also it's not in real life, but it's that Pepe the Frog thing.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That totally. Is literally a comic book that just by pasting that, it's a comic strip.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the cause, but just by taking that image, you're essentially saying, we are one of us.
And that's
weirdly, it feels like the most successful in our kind of current conversation, because the Handmaid's Tale stuff or anything maybe gets attention for a day or something, but that's the one that seems to have been able to completely co-opt the thing in volume, in mass, to create a new shorthand.
Yeah, would you see like Pepe the Frog in somebody's Twitter picture? You're like, all right, like, I know where this guy's coming from.
And just in case any of you listening are not familiar with this example, Pepe the Frog was a fairly benign cartoon character that has been co-opted by the alt-right and white supremacists. And it's been taken completely out of context, and it is a really interesting example of what we were talking about a little bit earlier about the role that social media and other emerging communication technologies really play in spreading and even creating propaganda and similar types of mythology. This is an image, a meme that really spread on Reddit and Twitter and other kind of corners of the social web. And I just don't think we would have seen something taken so drastically out of context so quickly 10 or 15 years ago, but before these ways of communicating existed.
Yeah, and it's sort of, to go to that technology, it's kind of virus-like, not in the in a negative, positive sense necessarily, but just the way something can spread. If it's sort of going through a decentralized process of getting around.
So, I mean, is that the future? Is the future of propaganda decentralized?
I kind of feel like stuff, like we've already stopped having, we've had state-sponsored narratives, but they don't feel like they start with states anymore. Do you know what I mean? I feel like, you know, whatever propaganda Trump's peddling, you know, starts on Reddit and 4chan and then goes to Fox and Friends and then goes to him. And then, so I feel like there's a centralized thing, but it's a bit more opaque and it's no longer a state thing. It's a narrative that's created in the darker, for the negative stuff, in a darker space, even for the positive stuff, in a more niche space that feels community-like, that's online or in social media and so on, because it has the reach. And then these things become movements that become, they have their own buzzwords and their languages and their avatars and their shorthands and their the signs and symbols and euphemisms that disguise certain things only the insiders can understand them or whatever. And then there are leaders who come along and say, okay, I understand all of this and I'll you know, make it mine, but I'm one of yours, but you're one of mine. It feels like that's sort of the new way. Instead of the state saying, this is what everybody has to buy into, it's that influential minority creating something that then somebody in turn can kind of put themselves in some form of acceptable leadership position of.
Yeah, while you were talking about that, I was thinking like, it seems like it would be so much simpler in North Korea. Like if you're a North Korean and coming to the US and trying to kind of understand, sort of decode what you were seeing around you, there's just so many messages at different sort of levels. Like you were talking about, you know, British football before, but like, you know, the NFL.
Oh yeah.
Here it's just
like killer, you know, propaganda.
It's all about the military. You know, they have flyovers, there are people at halftime. There's a book called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Oh, that's
It's a great book that makes it is pretty specific about that aspect of things. But it's, you know, there's just so much stuff that goes on. The movies, you know, most of these like aliens coming movies are, you know, in some ways propaganda for our, you know, our military, you know, because we're fighting off the aliens. So, you know, in some ways it seems like North Korea, where you basically, you know, you've got one guy that you're looking up to and there's certain modes of thought that are okay and the rest isn't. You know, I guess there's somewhat less to negotiate.
Yeah,
does that seem accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. It simplifies it immensely, and I think that's why North Korea, as a complete historical anomaly, has kind of been able to survive, because it happened at this time where it was able to shut itself down, sort of hermetically, but still have the technology to reach all of their people and keep them in grip, and be the single point of information. And that's why, you know, today there are a lot of activists who feel that the way to bring down the North Korean regime really is that thing of smuggling in USB keys and smuggling in TV shows and smuggling in Cho Yun-fat movies and just smuggling anything that makes that deceptively simple picture reveal itself as the lie that it is. because to come back around kind of full circle, that thing about sense of self and national sense and whatever, it's very brittle.
Well, it's just about time for us to start wrapping things up, but I just wanted to take a minute to thank our guest once again. His name is Paul Fisher. He is an award-winning film producer, and I want to get the book's name out there one more time so everyone can go buy it and read it. It's called A Kim Jong-il Production: The Extraordinary True Story of a Kidnapped Filmmaker, His Star Actress, and a Young Dictator's Rise to Power. Paul, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at TenCents77, which is TenCents77. And I think that's basically it. I've got a website, paulfisherauthor.com, where anybody can send me an email.
Toby, how about you? Where can people get you on Twitter?
At TobyBallNH. And I just wanted to quickly say that, you know, this the book isn't as like heavy as this discussion.
No, it's really not.
Was in some ways. I mean, it's a I don't want to say fun read, because I think that kind of can be a pejorative a little bit, but it's such a wacky story if you like listening to this podcast, I don't know why you wouldn't really enjoy the book.
And if anyone wants to find me on Twitter, I'm at @Meg_Heckman. Again, the show is at RF Dystopia, and we really hope to hear from you. Radio Free Dystopia is a production of Partners in Crime Media. Mike Nothnagel is our News from Dystopia announcer. If you like what you hear, please share a link to our show with your friends and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia.
Partners in Crime Media.